ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This episode contains the names and stories of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have passed away or disappeared.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
A lot of this has come from working with families and speaking to people sitting in inquests. One of the things we want to do at the Disappeared Project is actually build the evidence base around that. So it's not just me saying anecdotally, this is what happened, this is what happened. Like, we actually want to show the patterns to be able to support families, but also to take it to inquiries like coronial inquests, to take it further, to say, no, we're not just making this, families aren't just making it up. When a family rings us, we'll be able to say, no, like, this is shown in all of these other cases that there's a pattern.
That's part of the issue, is that we don't actually know why they're going missing. It is reliant currently on media reporting. It is reliant on families that bring forward these cases of missing men in particular. We've also seen the emerging pattern of that and it is consistent with missing women, missing children. So this is currently a cohort of people that are often referred to as going walkabout.
We also need better support systems for those at risk of going missing, men facing mental health crisis, homelessness, and are often the most vulnerable. And we need to strengthen our support services to prevent disappearances in the first place. These issues, please. At every level, from the community to the highest levels of government, we need to break the silence and demand the action that is long overdue.
The sleepy community in the West Australian wheat belt was home to young mother Veronica Lockyer and her 7-month-old baby, Adele. But in 1998, the pair vanished. It would be another 2 decades before they were reported missing.
The 25-year-old's body was found in an abandoned quarry in the Glasshouse Mountains last June.
Despite representing just 3% of the state's population, Aboriginal people make up 17% of all unsolved missing persons cases. What's more, Aboriginal mothers are 17 times more likely to be murdered than other mums.
I can't imagine families who are 20 years missing.
We realised that there was such an urgent need for an organisation who was able to help not just provide families with resources and help in every way, but to validate their concerns. Often we see language like walkabout, like drug addiction, like they'll just go away and they'll come back. And I think there are a lot of cases that we don't even know about.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. For decades, our Indigenous communities have been dealing with unimaginable tragedy. An epidemic of First Nations peoples disappearing from their communities, never to return. Last year, we saw a landmark inquiry into missing and murdered women and children, giving us a snapshot of the true impact on Aboriginal families when a loved one disappears. And while the inquiry was underway, Aboriginal people from around the country were still disappearing, families were still seeking justice, and police were still not acting urgently to help find their loved ones. Today you'll hear about one of those disappeared loved ones. His name is Jai, and I'll be talking with his sister Ginny Jones about how her family was able to find strength in harrowing circumstances. Then later, Dr. Amy McGuire joins me to talk about the Disappeared People Project that is helping families like Ginny's be supported. In June 2024, Jai, also known as Malachi by his family, was reported missing in Caboolture, Queensland. His sister Ginny was working in Sydney at the time and thought at first there wasn't cause for concern. He was 25 years old. Normally, he would be out with friends and then check in with family from time to time to see how they were going. But when her father called and said he hadn't seen or heard from Jai in weeks, she knew this wasn't like him. Ginny tells me about what her brother was like growing up and how her experience with the police around the circumstances surrounding his disappearance is a story many Aboriginal families know too well.
My brother Jai, he also went by Malachi, that was his little chosen name. Jai was, had such like an innocence about him. Ever since, like when I think of Jai, I think of him as a baby. He just had this full head of curly hair. He had the rosiest cheeks. He like slobbered everywhere. It was just like the loveliest baby. It rolls in all the right places, I guess, as you want it as a baby. And so that's how I sort of remember him a lot in my head. But I think, you know, Jai was this incredibly kind, empathetic, thoughtful person. And like if I had to describe him in any type of way, like everyone's best friend. Yeah.
Take us back to the day he went missing. What was that like for you and your family?
Yeah, I think back at that time, I think we did what I think a lot of families do. You know, Jai's 24, 25 years old. I think we just, when my family sort of brought it to our attention that he hadn't checked in with anyone, instantly I just sort of assumed that he was out with friends having the time of his life. Although it was, you know, uncommon for him because Jai, he needs people to live. He needs people to, he's the sort of person that has constant people around him. So I did think it was kind of strange. And it wasn't until I think I got to have a conversation with our dad and he sort of said to me, I think this is something really serious. It's unlike him to not return my phone calls or texts, especially when, you know, my dad would send Jai little bits of money here and there to get him through the week. So it wasn't until I spoke to our dad that, and he expressed that sort of concern, I thought, okay, if my dad's taking it seriously, then, you know, we probably need to do something about this. And I was in Sydney at the time at work and jumped back on a plane back to Brisbane and went to my dad's first thing in the morning and did what I guess I thought was the best thing to do, which is make missing persons flyers and start, you know, going through the community that Jai had lived in and asking people if they'd seen him.
So once you started to do that, it must have started to hit you that something really was wrong.
Yeah. I think it's like that moment if you've ever, you know, had a young person and you've lost sight of them for that second, that's sort of feeling that pit in my stomach and it just didn't go away. So I think, it was really scary. But again, in the back of my mind, just thinking he's 25, he's got lots of friends, he's got, you know, quite the life. Surely, you know, his phone's just, you know, maybe he's broken his phone or whatever. In the back of my head, I just kept trying to rationalize the situation. But yeah, that pit in my stomach remained the entire time.
And when did you decide to reach out to the police and what kind of support or response did you get?
Yeah, initially my dad had reached out to the police. And so in my mind again, I think I hadn't reached out to the police assuming that this conversation had already had and I didn't want to overwhelm them. But once I got back to Brisbane and got into Caboolture and I dropped my dad off at the police station, yeah, really disappointed in the response. You know, when we first got there, a receptionist was like, we're all really aware of the situation and we're all looking for Jai and this is a high priority for the station. And so I think initially I sort of was like, okay, everyone knows what's going on. There's people looking. But throughout my interactions with the police over the next few days, I started to realize that that priority actually wasn't as high as I'd been told.
And of course, there was a very tragic outcome in this story. And I wonder if you could share with us how it was that you found out that actually Jai had passed away.
Yeah, it was gut-wrenching. I think when I think back, I think there was a part of me that knew a little earlier in the piece because it was so unlike him. And the more that I thought about the situation and how much I knew Jai and what he was like. But again, in even today, you know, more than a year on, it still doesn't feel real. And I think even more than that, in how it all ended up playing out, still feels really unreal.
What sort of information did you get about the circumstances around his death? How much support did you get in terms of coming to terms with what had happened and understanding what had happened to him?
Yeah, look, little to no detail. And obviously because it is an active case, I understand that there are things that we can't know right now. However, it was made obvious to me that because also, you know, Jai and I are not biologically brother and sister. We grew up in foster care together and we're the only family that Jai's consistently known. And so it was becoming more aware, I was becoming more aware that the police were also going to pick and choose what information they gave to us because they could say that we weren't biologically related. So for me, the police maintaining communication with my dad afterwards, I guess has been the only communication that we've had. And I've been just really cautious of not overstepping a boundary and then them saying, we're not going to give anyone any information. So I guess that's the state in which it currently is.
So I was wondering, now that you've been through this process and how you've been treated, when you look back, what do you think could have been done differently by the police that could have made you feel more supported and had helped you through in the trauma that you were going through with what had happened to Jai?
Yeah, that's a great question. I honestly don't know. In a lot of ways, my interaction with the police prior to this situation hasn't always been positive. So, you know, I talked to one of our colleagues, Kevin, quite a lot about this, is that feeling of like having to walk into the police station with my tail between my legs because I need their help. And so I found myself doing lots of things and saying lots of things that I probably wouldn't have said or done because I wanted them to see the humanity in me and see the humanity in my family. And so I felt like I was almost begging them to help. And when I look back at the situation and my interaction with them over the course of Jai's case, it was really disappointing. Although I know this to be true, right? I hear it, I've heard it over and over again of interactions with the police like this for our people. But just the little seeds that they'd already started planting for us to maybe never know what happened to Jai. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, not validating our concerns, talking to us like we didn't know who Jai was. Like, it was a lot of gaslighting. I was starting to notice them say stuff like, well, we have a much more rounder idea of who Jai was, and you may have only just seen this part because you're his family. But that like feeling in my deep in my chest and deep in my gut being like, no, this isn't right and this isn't it. Having to push through those moments of like, I do know him and I am the best positioned person in this room right now to tell you why. And I guess for me, I wonder now how many other families find themselves in situations like this and not being able to advocate for themselves at the mercy of the people who are supposed to protect and help us.
One of the things I really admire about you, Ginny, is that you've had this unspeakable tragedy happen, and amongst all of what you've been coping with, you've now, in many ways, using your experience to help others. Can you tell us about the Disappeared Project and why you wanted to be involved?
Yeah. I think our family was really lucky in a lot of ways that I was able to rally up friends and family who worked in these really niche spaces of helping, you know, mob who experience stuff like this in different ways. So I was really lucky that, you know, Kevin Yao Yi, who's one of our colleagues at the Disappeared Project, had, you know, worked in lots of different spaces, particularly as a youth worker, who could provide that support to me in validating my concerns. He was really the first person who was like, yeah, Ginny, there's something wrong with this. And I would tell him, you know, little bits of information and interactions that I had with, you know, the police or other people involved in the case. And he was like, yes, you know, these are real concerns. And I think him backing me and then bringing into the fold Dr. Amy Maguire, who's also a colleague over at the Disappeared Project, and her experience in these sorts of cases and really pushing and advocating for me. You know, they were very helpful in dealing with the media and, you know, I was also very cautious of like not doing anything that would make this harder to convict the people involved in this case. There was lots of, you know, things that I, and now looking back, things that I obviously had no idea about where Amy and Kevin were able to step in and help me. And I guess for us, it was like a natural progression into this space of like, if this is what we're experiencing in real time, what support and what resources do other families have when these sorts of things happen? And then meeting with Amy and Kevin and yarning about now some of the other people who have been disappeared in this country and their stories and how there is no data or information about how big this problem is, really inspired us, I guess, to put our heads together and figure out what we can do to support people who will experience stuff like this in their lifetime.
Just from your own experience, we get so much exposure to true crime on television, in film. We often have a sense of what should happen when something goes wrong because we have that exposure through the media. I wonder, just now that you've had that personal experience yourself, how different was the reality that you experienced to what you might have expected would happen just based on what you'd seen on television?
Yeah, look, I guess it depends what kind of true crime you're watching, you know. It's not Law and Order. You know, it's not summarized at the end. There isn't finality, if that makes sense. I feel like this just goes forever and ever and ever. And to be honest, I can't imagine what my life will be like when this is over. Yeah, what's next for us and our family and the impacts that this will have on our family. Yeah, I think you watch TV and you think, okay, someone's going to get caught and then they go to jail for the rest of their lives. But the reality of that and the reality for so many First Nations families in this country when this sorts of stuff happens is that it's not anywhere close to what you might see on TV.
I think you're extraordinarily brave in speaking out at a time when there's so much happening in your life. And I'm sure other people who are listening to your story will have a deeper insight into what needs to change within the system. But I'm sure there are also people who are listening who have been through something similar, and you're probably empowering them as well. So thank you so much for your bravery and your words and your advocacy, Ginny. I'm sure it'll have a powerful impact, even though, of course, things with Jai's case remain so unresolved.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Ginny Jones, the co-founder of the Disappeared People Project. She was sharing with me the story about her brother Jai's disappearance. It was incredibly brave of her to take the time to speak with us, and we'll be sure to keep in touch.
need you to see what this does to me. Time bleeds these streets dry of everything. How you gonna judge my make but not my maker? How you gonna take these thoughts from out my head? How you gonna come tell me I need to wake up? How you gonna learn to live with my regrets? My heart won't start running empty since day one. Too broken to hold it in. My mind floods like I've been drowning this whole time. Too late to learn to swim. See, I wouldn't put all the blame onto my God if he gave up. Already forsaken, son, and thinking that should be enough. For my soul, let's go. Tired of fighting the devil. This is me just giving up. Even if I can't do half the things you want, still paid my dues I could afford. My time will come when I have moved on. My mind's still ill, my body gone. Still gonna judge my mate but not my maker. Still trying to scream these thoughts from out my head. Still telling me that I just need to wake up. Start learning how to live with my regrets. My heart won't start running empty since day one. Too broken to hold it. It's like I've been drowning this whole time. Too late to learn to swim. See, I wouldn't put all the blame onto my God if he gave up. Already forsaken, son, and thinking that should be enough. For my soul, let's go. Tired of fighting the devil. This is me just giving up. You ignore everything. Everything I wanted. Say no to everything. Everything I need. If you know about everything, then what if I am nothing to myself? Can you tell me what my hell? My heart won't start running empty since day one. Too broken to hold it in. My mind. It's like I've been drowning this whole time. Too late to learn to swim. See, I wouldn't put all the blame onto my God if he gave up. Already forsaken, son, and figured that should be enough. But my soul, let's go. Tired of fighting the devil. This is me just giving up.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
Earlier on the show, we heard the story of Jai Gray's disappearance from his sister, Ginny Jones. Throughout their dealings with the police, they were able to rely on people they knew around them that had similar experiences who were able to offer support when the police were of limited help. This led Ginny to connect with Dr. Amy McGuire, who has worked within the justice system, sat through countless inquests, and given testimonies to various inquiries. Throughout their dealings with the police, they were able to rely on people they knew around them that had had similar experiences, who were able to offer support when the police were of limited help. This led Ginny to connect with Dr. Amy McGuire, who worked within the justice system. This led Ginny to connect with Dr. Amy McGuire, who has worked within the justice system, sat through countless inquests, and given testimonies at various inquiries. Amy has used her experiences to write her award-winning book, Black Witness, that gives you insight into what it means to tell stories with a lived experience. Most recently, she has been involved in the inquiry into missing and murdered women and children, which led her to cover more of this topic on her podcast, Curtain. Now she works alongside Ginny at the Disappeared Peoples Project, helping to better support families and take back autonomy in the search for their disappeared loved ones. Amy McGuire, welcome back to Speaking Out.
It's always good to be here.
Well, I feel like every time we have you on, you're doing something new and important. So it's great to see that your advocacy is finding new ways to make an impact. Let's start with the Disappearance Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you got involved with it?
Yeah, I mean, the Disappeared Project was really, the impetus was when our colleague Ginny's brother, Jai, was disappeared in Caboolture. And the difference in this situation was I was working on a lot of cases which were 10 years old or 30 years old in which Aboriginal women had been disappeared, and that disappearance had been entrenched because of the early failures of the police. And it's always grounded in both racism and gendered violence, which we know is enduring in the police and particularly the Queensland police. So I think in this situation, Kevin Yaoyi, my colleague at Corumba Institute, he called me one day and introduced me to Ginny. And everything that the family was experiencing in real time were things that we were actually looking into at the moment and that we'd seen play out routinely and were patterns of the Queensland police. And so within 3 days, when there was a really horrific outcome in Jaya's case, we sort of started to think we need to continue what we had learnt over, it took space, I think, in 4 or 5 days. And it was really Ginny who reached out and said, we need to start something bigger, because from what I know, so many families had also experienced this. And particularly in the early days of a disappearance, that really impacts the investigation for years later. And it also is the thing that really compounds trauma for a lot of families, you know, like going into the police station and just being turned away, or having your loved one seen in certain ways, seen as a criminal and not believed. And those are the things that people don't realise are what can be incredibly traumatic for families that last for decades. And so that's really how it started. We started to think, well, what needs to happen in this area? Because obviously overseas, there is a lot of campaigns around crises like missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, particularly in Canada. There's advocacy around feminicide in Latin America, but we don't have that groundswell of, research showing the patterns over here in Australia. And that's not to say there's not people working on them, but we just didn't have sort of a body that specifies, I guess, in this area. And we felt like there was a need for that.
Reflecting on the fact that we haven't had the same level of coordination here in the way that you've described as happening in other jurisdictions, I know that you gave evidence in the federal inquiry around missing and murdered Indigenous women and children. And I just wonder what your reflections were on participating in that and the outcomes, because, of course, that was, I think many of us who've worked with victims of crime had hoped that that might be the sort of thing that could lead to the sort of change that you're talking about.
I was really disappointed because I did also have high hopes in the inquiry, just because it was the first time that this has even happened. And it's sort of that landmark. You would hope that it would spark and reveal what Black families all across the country already know to be true. But what I found when I went to the inquiry, and we ended up speaking to the inquiry twice. So I spoke to the inquiry when they went down to Barrowville with you, Larissa. And then we did another one as part of ICRR in our submission in ICR at the Institute of Collaborative Race Research, which was foregrounded on a lot of the cases in Queensland. And what I found was I just didn't think there was an acceptance that this is a crisis. Like, there seemed to be a lack of acknowledgement that this is happening, or a refusal to believe. And I think it showed in the final report, where there was only 10 recommendations. And I just think, given the scale of the trauma and the fact that we have so many Black women, but also Black men and children who are disappeared all across the country, and their cases are, you know, like the police will always say that a missing persons investigation is always active. It never closes until the person is found. They're not really. And families have to go to like greater lengths in order to be believed. And I just didn't feel there was an acknowledgement of that either in the questioning at the inquiry or the final report. And particularly in Queensland, I was really, really disappointed. Like, they didn't even touch on the actual crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Like, there were very few questions actually looking at this specific area, and it focused a lot on reform of the police when I think people have to understand that a lot of the time the police, and this is why we talk about disappearance as a term, the police become part of that apparatus because they help entrench the disappearance. And you see, you know, like right now we have a very high profile missing persons case over a child in South Australia, Gus. We never get that same level of media attention. Like never. It never happens. And we saw that also with Cleo Smith. There's just a lack of care and a lack of worry about the disappearances of Black men, women and children. And we see that repeatedly. You know, our lives are seen as less worthy and less grievable. But also, it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a child or a woman. If you're Black, it's almost like you're seen as responsible for your own disappearance. And that's what happened with Jai. And that's what happened with so many. I mean, the majority of families that I've talked to, like their loved ones have been seen as responsible for their own disappearance.
Words are really powerful. I'm always reminded of that when I speak with you, Amy. And you did touch on this, but I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about why you make use of the term disappeared instead of missing, which on Speaking Out, we'll be using that terminology as well.
It was very deliberate to use disappeared, and it really came from sitting in particularly the inquest into Monique Club, who is an Aboriginal woman who was disappeared in Queensland in 2013. She was last seen in Beenleigh at a shopping centre in Beenleigh. And when I was sitting through that inquest, they kept using this term missing, but missing was used in certain ways in the inquest to again place responsibility back onto Monique. So it would be just like she's run off into the park. There was a huge belief that she had just overdosed in the park and that she had not been found in the park, which did not make sense to me. Do you know what I mean? And that word missing was being used to obscure all of these other responsibilities and particularly bypass police responsibility because if they had searched for her with the urgency that her case deserved, then her family wouldn't be 10, 11, 12 years still waiting for any form of answers. And so it was really talking to my colleague, Sharandev Singh, and he spoke about missing is not the right word. We should be using disappearance, disappeared, in line with if your listeners are aware to a lot of the scholarship in Latin America around the enforced disappearances. It widens this term to incorporate all these other actors beyond the person who has perpetrated the crime. So I keep talking about entrenching the disappearance, but that was what was the real worry with Jai. Once, you know, the search is over, becomes a lot harder to find the person. So it's things like the media, like the refusal to cover the disappearances, the refusal to believe families, but also the refusal to really humanize or presence the loved ones so that we get a sense of who they are. And then it's the police who just literally refuse to search a lot of the time. And there are really horrific cases where we know that they don't search and they don't search for Aboriginal peoples, or they don't consider their disappearances high priority, like Jai and like so many other cases. They're not considered high risk disappearances. And then the state, because we saw the inquiry, the refusal to actually take these cases seriously and to show them as a pattern tied to the colonial violences and the colonial disappearances of our people across this country. And particularly in Queensland, I feel that so keenly, because I always think about disappearance in the context of genocide in Queensland and the fact that we don't know where a lot of our loved ones and our ancestors were buried. And so it widens this term of missing to incorporate this wider violence that particularly impacts and targets First Nations peoples. And I also incorporate the justice system in that, the continual disappearing of our men, women and children behind bars, and then the killings that take place inside. To me, those are disappearances as well. And so it's sort of like a wider term to incorporate what actually is happening rather than just saying missing, because often when they say missing, it's like, oh, they've just run off, they've gone off, they'll come back one day. And so it bypasses all of these levels of state-sanctioned violence that we see when we centre Aboriginal peoples. Because I think also it is also a case in non-Indigenous cases where missing people go missing and there are abject police failures, but like it is magnified when it comes to blackfellas.
One thing you've touched on there that I think is really important to maybe draw out a bit, you've focused your journalism and your writing on this issue on many cases. And now, you know, you're evolving that work into more active actual support and law reform in the space. Across the cases, the many cases you've looked at, you must be seeing things, you've seen enough of them to know what the trends are in terms of the way the police and the state work in these issues or don't work. I mean, it's not like you've just looked at a couple of cases and, you know, you are now in a position to be able to draw those threads together and see what the trends are.
A lot of this has come from working with families and speaking to people sitting in inquests. One of the things we want to do at the Disappeared Project is actually build the evidence base around that. So it's not just me saying anecdotally, this is what happened, this is what happened. Like, we actually want to show the patterns to be able to support families, but also to take it to inquiries like coronial inquests, to take it further, to say, no, we're not just making this, families aren't just making it up. When a family rings us, we'll be able to say, no, like this is shown in all of these other cases that there's a pattern. And I think one of the main threads that runs through, which I think people won't even be shocked at, is the police and the levels of racism within the police when it comes to those who've been disappeared and just the ways they speak to families, the ways they continue to criminalise. So, you know, when a family mother goes to a police station, immediately they're seen almost as a nuisance, like their loved one is an addict or they're criminalised because so often the police are only there to surveil black people. So when we're actually going there to find them, they only look for them as wanted persons. They can only see them in a certain prism. That's seen something I've seen throughout every single case. And that often isn't illuminated in any inquiry or any inquest because racism and race is always made absent in these sort of inquiries which are done by the state to alibi themselves. And it's so being able to build that evidence base to be able to support further work. And we're based in Queensland, so we've already, like, we start sort of in the place that we know. And what we want to do is expand it so other mob in other states and territories will be able to use that for their own experiences. And so that's why the Disappeared Project as well has emerged, because I just felt there was a necessity to have that research and that evidence base and to build upon what has already been done as well. Like, I think for me, and Larissa, I think I talk about this every time as well, is just like the Bowerville families just changed my whole perspective on everything. And I think learning from their fight and their tenacity and their refusal and their resistance, I see that in every single family that I talk to. And so it's about being able to support families first and foremost and have the research to be able to do that.
I think it's extraordinary how much the Bowerville families have changed all of us who've had the privilege of working with them in some way or another. They're absolutely inspirational in terms of what they continue to advocate for, aren't they? I also just wanted to direct people to your podcast. This season you focused on this topic, and it's another way for people to really more deeply dive into the work you've done in the space and to understand the issues more. So can you tell us a little bit about what you've covered in the season?
Yeah, I mean, Curtain is sort of a really grassroots effort, I must say. Like, it's not as highly produced as a lot of other podcasts out there, but Curtain really started with the wrongful conviction of an Aboriginal man named Kevin Henry. But the victim in that case was an Aboriginal woman from South Australia named Linda. And this a lot of this work actually emerges from her story too, because in all of the media and all of the court cases, she was just completely, I would say, disappeared again within the actual court. they just didn't care about her as an Aboriginal woman. And so there are these unique and particularly horrific violences that are perpetrated against Aboriginal women. And so we wanted to really focus on that in our continual work with Curtin. And it's one of those things is we, I was sitting in a lot of inquests in Queensland, which was specifically around disappearances of Aboriginal women, and seeing the depths of the way the Queensland police treated the families. So even when the police do search, often they're searching in the wrong areas. In one case, in the case of Constance May Wacho, who was found in Kangaroo Point, which listeners around the should know, it's, you know, quite an affluent suburb. It's right on the Brisbane River. It's right underneath, at one point, the most expensive mansion sold in Queensland, which was owned by the Brisbane Broncos CEO. They didn't search for her once. They didn't conduct a physical search for her for 10 months before she was found. And it was her family who had to come in from Cherbourg to search. And I was just seeing, I just couldn't, sometimes I was sitting there going, I can't believe this is happening. Like, I don't think people will believe this when I tell people. But because the media as well doesn't cover them properly, and because there is a silence in the coronial process, you don't understand the levels of violence that come to play. So we just felt there was a need for like a focus on that. But I think the other problem which has happened in Australia, not caused by blackfellas, but caused by the state, has been they only look at certain violences. And so obviously they only look on black on what they call like black on black violence. And it's so important to have a focus on family violence in so many different ways, but it's talked about in the ways that black communities don't talk about it. It's talked about in the way that it really bypasses the role of invasion, colonization, but the continuing violence for example, like the justice system. You know, and we don't talk about like the Northern Territory, for example. They don't talk about the ways the state has enacted really horrific violence upon all communities that has continued the violence. So I think that's been part of the issue is that the state continually silences black women who are the knowers and the experts on violence. And they refuse to. They continually refuse to. They're, black women are always spoken of. So I think the bypassing of the voices of black women in so many different forms has been the real reason why the silence around these issues have continued. And they're all interconnected as well, but they're all complex. And so it's trying to unravel some of that to be able to speak about it in a safe way that doesn't enact further violence. So that's what we try and do in the podcast at a really grassroots level. But it's also part of what we're trying to do at the Disappeared Project. So we can speak of it in the way that is safe to speak of it.
It strikes me too that one of the worst things that happens in this system is that it silences the families. And I think what's so powerful about your work is that you give them a voice back, and that in itself is a really important part of the process. I'm going to ask you a question that's kind of unfair because I don't know the answer to it either, but with all the work you've been doing, and particularly the specific cases you've worked on, the families you've worked with, I wonder if you have any thoughts on what does justice look like in this space?
Yeah, that is something I think about a lot, and I really have no idea, because every time you think you know, something happens and you realize, oh, that wasn't justice, you know? And because in this area of disappearance, the thing that is particularly traumatic and unique about it is that there's just the unknowing. There's always the unknowing and the ability to name what has happened. And I think that's why it's so similar when I was reading a lot of work around enforced disappearance, but also femicide in Mexico and Argentina and Chile. It's that unknowing, and that's what makes justice really hard to find as well, because it's also elusive. And so the fact that there might not be an end, or there might not be a justice, like sometimes I think justice must be in the fight, or justice must be something up in the air that we'll never fully get. It's really hard. Sometimes I don't think it's achievable, but maybe it's the fight to continue the fight for justice that keeps people going. I really don't know. It's such an imperfect answer.
Imperfect question in a way, but
yeah,
we use the word and I just struggle with it myself.
Yeah, I do too. Sometimes I don't know what it means at all.
Amy, thank you so much again for spending time with us on Speaking Out. I'm always humbled by the importance of your work, the power of your voice, and just your unrelenting advocacy for people who've been so badly treated by the system and helping them to find a voice and some power back in it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Larissa.
That was Dr. Amy McGuire there talking to us about the Disappeared Peoples Project. The issue has been an ongoing epidemic in Indigenous communities for decades. Before Jai, there were many cases like his where Indigenous men have disappeared and the cases still remain open. This is not an uncommon issue. It is an epidemic of disappeared First Nations peoples that we must continue to bring attention to so their families can bring their loved ones home. And just a warning, if these conversations have raised issues for you, or if you're concerned about someone you know, call the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Crisis Support Line 13 Yarn or 1800 RESPECT.
Coffee every morning comes from a place that's far away, and when I'm done, I feel like talking without you here, there is less to say. Don't want you thinking I'm unhappy. What is closer to the truth? And if I lived till I was 102, I just don't think I'll ever get over you. Drink strong whiskey. I shook the hand of time and I knew that if I lived till I could no longer climb my stairs, I just don't think I'll ever get over you. Me years. to dinner. 'Cause I'm here to say that I sometimes do. And even though I still feel a touch of love, I just don't think I'll ever get over you. I was 102. I just don't think I'll ever get over you.
That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaya Gibbs-Muir and Nadine Haynes. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our titter show Away, hosted by the wonderful Rudy Bremer. This week, she's taking you to Kaurna Country for Tanandi 2025. The Biennial Festival is celebrating 10 years at the South Australian Art Gallery and will feature the work of artists like Marie Clark, Vincent Namatjira and Judy Watson. I'm Larissa Berendt and this is Speaking Out.
You know, festivals like this too, who bring mob from all over the country here, it's just you can't really describe how much love there is.
Yeah, finding that balance of power, the power dynamics, the transaction of things, the extraction of things, you know, how much we're giving in the space, because we do catch ourselves, because I think, you know, being who we are and, you know, you do want to just keep giving and holding space and...
Yeah, I'm so, you know, excited, happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And now... is to the world to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, show our painting, stories, songline. Yes.
Been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.